Well, what was the highlight for you?
Oh, did I enjoy the UK trip? I can't answer that. Words don't really sort of describe how awesome that trip was. I mean, first off, it's the first overseas trip I've taken in at least 3 years. So,
Wow.
I mean, just getting on the plane again, just going to the airport. I mean, I won't count New Zealand as overseas. It's technically over the Tasman Sea, but you know what I mean. So yeah, first trip in years. And then I started JobAdder almost 2 years ago in July of 2020. And since then the team has more than doubled in size. It's gone from about 90 to about 250. And I hadn't met anybody overseas, right? I haven't met a lot of people here as well with everything that's been going on. So just to meet the team there, meet some customers, meet you and just to hang out, go to the bar late and have a few drinks and then be in London again, it was amazing.
That's fantastic to hear. And I'm feeling the same way. As you know, I'm in Australia now. And it's the first big trip I've done for a long time. And yeah, it was crazy. But I've realized how important it is to meet people and to reconnect in this embodied sense, I'm calling it now. Forget in person. It's the embodiment of this contact, which is really, really important. Anyway, we should talk about this because CEOing in the remote first world is one of the big sort of elements of the new game now, isn't it, for folks like you? Like, how do you do it? Do you need new skills and stuff? So we'll definitely explore it. But welcome, everybody. We're live. This is Founders Focus, episode 24. And we're shifting it. We usually do this on Wednesdays, but we're shifting it today on Friday, really to accommodate my schedule. So apologies for people who are usually expecting this show to happen on Wednesdays. But as I mentioned to Martin, I'm actually in Australia at this point. And we had to do some juggling to make sure these conversations continue to happen on a weekly basis. It has turned into the thing that I enjoy to do the most because I really enjoy speaking to, I call them like recruiting maniacs, people who for some reason think it's a good idea to fundamentally solve the problems of recruiting and to take on these big leadership jobs to try and do that. So I'm really pleased to welcome to the show Martin Herbst, CEO of JobAdder. So Martin, welcome to Founders Focus, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And you actually, just on your point about the timing, I'm glad that we pushed it from Wednesday to Friday because I'm now day three with COVID.
Oh, what? I didn't know, man. How are you feeling?
No, it's I honestly feel like one of the lucky ones. I sort of got it off easy. I've been telling COVID I'm not impressed. It actually hasn't been so bad. Actually, I'm at home. My oldest son, he tested positive on Saturday, and there's five of us here. And then the domino started to fall, and so I'm actually doing, I'm pretty all right. So I actually happy to be here, all things considered.
Okay, well, if you need to take some sort of break or whatever, let me know. I'm sorry to hear that you've come down with illness, but hopefully, fingers crossed, it'll be a mild case, and you and your family will get through it okay. It's interesting because it's almost like our mental attitude has to change as well. I'm traveling. I'm meeting a bunch of people. I can't tell you that these are super, super safe events. I mean, essentially, you are like interacting in close proximity. And it's a matter of time, I think. And we just got to hope the boosters and the vaccines and, where we're at with things is going to be okay for us. But thank you even more so for attending the show, Martin. I usually start it by saying, what important CEOing things have you canceled in order to appear on Founders Focus? But maybe in the COVID scenario, it's simply about, getting out of bed for this 1 hour. But what did you intend to do? I mean, is there a typical thing that you do at this time of day?
This time of day, it was just 12 o'clock, Sydney time. I've got I'm not I got that Clockwise app that helps block out sort of that 1 hour, so for focus time, but for really grabbing lunch. So I do like to take advantage of that. I had been for years and years and years, and I'm still guilty of this, but would just grab lunch and eat at my desk and just try and work through stuff. And one of my old managers, who I had for a very long time, learned a lot from him, always used to chastise me. He's like, "What are you doing? It's like, get away from your desk. Like, just walk away." And so I've been, I keep hearing his voice quite a bit. Like, if I ever find myself doing that, so stepping away and then having like, you know, lunch, and then like, you know, ideally if you're in, if I am in the office, obviously not right now, grab some, you know, some lunch with a colleague is the best thing I'll be doing right now. Like, to, for me, the biggest things is not about more stuff to do. How am I actually taking breaks from doing stuff so I can, like, you know, just step back and gather myself and just have some moments.
You know what? That's actually a really important life lesson, also a really important leadership lesson as well, because I think your old boss, it's amazing that he's had that impact. I'm guilty of this. Everyone is guilty at, you know, at desk typing away, getting, you know, pizza crust in your keyboard and stuff, thinking that you're just optimizing for productivity. But what you're doing is probably overeating. This is a classic way where you eat too much, or you're not concentrating on how you're feeling with the food that's coming in. And you're not doing anything particularly interesting as you're, or important as you're eating. There's no way that you're pushing the business in any way forward during that period. You just kind of, it's really just guilt more than anything else. So yeah, you absolutely need to take that break and get away. Let's start there, Martin. I mean, you've sort of worked in big companies. You've had exposure to people who have been great managers, probably some folks that have not been so great in terms of their management style. Can you pick out like one or two characters? When I ask you, okay, who have been the influential people that have kind of helped you build your own leadership style? Can you think of who those people are and what lessons you learned particularly from those folks?
Yeah, and I have been in some big organizations. I've also been quite lucky. I feel really lucky, like, you know, and really blessed in sort of the environments that I've been in. So, you know, it's eBay and PayPal, and for the last, you know, for about 15 years before I joined JobAdder, and then some other, you know, companies before that. But typically, I've always been more in the startup part of the organization, that's sort of like incubation or anything like that. So, have been able to have that sort of that nice sort of combination between, hey, lots of autonomy, lots of ability to have impact, to be able to run really fast, but then to get the kind of support from a larger corporate sort of structure and funding, et cetera. And what you do is you know, I learned at least a couple of things. One is, like, you know, how to move really fast, but then also how to actually, you know, manage stakeholders, you know, within a large organization. It's an interesting combination. But in terms of things that I've learned, yeah, you know, I think when I have got like two faces in my head right now, this guy, you know, Chris, this other guy, Malta, and one or two others. And I've got another face of someone else that I say wasn't a good leader. Yeah. And so the difference between them, I think a lot is ability to connect and listen. I think that's a massive difference in terms of people I've looked up to, is like, you know, how well they actually, it's not about, hey, you know, the ideas that they have, like, you know, how much they talk. It's actually how much they are actually listening to you to understand things that you're trying to solve, and then helping you, you know, find the ways to be able to solve them, you know, pretty much, like, you know, in terms of, like, you know, leader as a coach, really, essentially. So When I think about, like, you know, the overall leaders who I find most inspiring is that they, why do they say certain things that resonate with you? Why do they say certain things that, you know, really connect with you? Because they're probably very good listeners. You know, they have tapped into how people are feeling and what they're hearing back from customers or what have you. And they're able to capture that in a way that resonates, and then maybe shed some light on, well, hey, here's what we could do. It's next.
Yeah. Fast. Active listening is the term, isn't it? And, you know, I think we're getting better at understanding what that is, but it is not just superficially trying to listen to the words, but what is the meaning behind the words, and what is the motivations that this person is, you know, what are the intrinsic reasons why this person is communicating to you in this way, and the ability to just listen to what the unsaid things, right? You know, sometimes when you're talking, there's stuff that you're expressing explicitly, but there's also stuff that you're implicitly communicating. And you need to stop and really pay attention to all of those cues in order for you to truly understand what the situation is.
Yeah, that's right. And, like, just take this moment right now, right? So you and me talking right now, as you're speaking, right? I am taking you in what you're saying, And then at the same time, I'm trying to process and say, okay, hey, what's the next thing I could potentially say? Now, but that's already an issue, right? Because now I'm trying to double process. And I'm losing some of the stuff that you're saying to actually be able to then communicate the next thing. So, and I've seen like, you know, so I've mentioned two leaders that I found were fairly good at that. Have seen another leader, which, you know, I was, you know, uninspired by. And, you know, he would be, you know, the guy in the top of the chain, right? And he would be in meetings and he would be, you know, you'd be trying to do your presentation or talk to someone, you know, you feel is very important, right? And he'd be on his phone. And he'd be, you know, wow, doing something else. And everyone knew you had like maybe a few minutes of attention to be able to get to your point, and then it was gone. And that's just demoralizing. But like, I think, you know, just having to be able to capture yourself in the moment, be like, okay, this is what I need to pay attention to right now, like what you are saying, and focus in on that, and then eliminate the noise and the chatter that's sort of distracting you away from that.
You know what? That's a really important point. I think when you're having a conversation and there's a like an obvious disengagement from the other side, it's certainly disrespectful. And if you're not able to provide the full focus for that particular point, or you shouldn't have taken the meeting. You know, just don't take the meeting if you can't pay attention. It doesn't matter the level of seniority you are. If you are busy with something else that's more important at that time, that's totally cool. Just reschedule. You know, I remember actually, wasn't that recently, maybe a month or so ago, I had a call with somebody who, you know, came in and they were actually asking me for a favor. And I was happy to entertain what they were saying. But, during the course of the call, it was very clear that the person was other stuff on her mind. You know, looking at another tab, looking at other things. And you know, I appreciate she's a busy person. But I was thinking, okay, if that's the case, then, you know, let's reschedule this conversation, which you asked for. I have no problem with that. I understand interrupts happen, but don't try and continue something. And as you say, double processing, not getting sort of optimal value out of any of those processes because you're splitting time. Best you can do is 50-50. But at the same time, it's like destructive from a relationship point of view.
Yeah.
Because my motivation to support this person has obviously been damaged now. Because you know, as a human being, you don't want to go in there and waste your own time, and you're more likely to give a commitment to stuff if the other person shows the minimal degree of commitment to you. Startups always talk about minimum viable product. What's the minimum viable respect? Right? What is the minimum viable commitment? But yeah, really interesting to know that CEOs oftentimes obviously super time constrained. There's always going to be a list of things that you can't do, right? So you have to say, I should do it, but I can't. So you accept that. And I guess the leader that you were, that was in your mind who did try to do that probably had the view that, you know what, I can put 30% of my attention here. That's sufficient. And I could do 20% here and that's sufficient.
Yeah.
But it isn't.
Yeah. And I think, you know, what we're talking about, maybe it was in the framework or the context of, you know, being a leader or CEO. But of course, what we're talking about is, you know, applicable to, you know, whatever position you're in, particularly when you're recruiting, right? I mean, if you're interviewing somebody, right, you're talking to a candidate or you're, you know, having a, you know, a briefing meeting with a client, you know, you got to be tapped in, right? You know, otherwise, you know, you're losing, you know, that moment, right? So, often, by the way, that's a little bit of a signal to me when I know. You know, that the candidate that I'm talking to, because, you know, of course, we're recruiting lots of people. I'm recruiting some people into my leadership team right now. There's a little signal that I'll write down later. It's like, you know, how was I distracted, you know, at all during the meeting? And not as if myself, it's sort of like, well, am I connecting with this person? So that focus, that mindfulness and to be able to connect, I think it's a virtue no matter, you know, sort of whatever situation you're in.
That's actually a really interesting potential product direction for job adder, you know. I've been very interested in like a newish category of product on interview analytics and trying to monitor, because we kind of interview people, but we presume that we are consistent in terms of our own interview attention, our own interview efforts and so on. But of course, that's not the case because how we interview someone pre-coffee might be different from how we interview post-coffee. Or maybe at the end, you know, you currently undergoing some illness, Martin. So your body and your mind is telling you different things. Your sensations are all different. Are you still the same interviewer if you're fully fit and healthy? And I'm very interested in this sort of category where people are trying to, you know, record screen time, do things like sentiment analysis, do things like interrupts, do things like how many questions does Martin typically ask during the course of a 60-minute interview? Has that gone up or down during the course of this? And I think I should know that as a recruiter. I want to know that.
Yeah, because you know, if you think about recruitment technology, what are we trying to do, right? We're trying to make the process of recruitment, you know, amplify the skills that we have as humans to be able to make that process even more effective and more successful, right? Humans are at the center of it, right? And that's also what makes the technology or the innovation around it so difficult, right? It's we're multi-layered, complex, you know, people, beings, etc. How do you, if you're going to automate things, you're going to provide insights, it's a multi-layered way to be able to do that. But when you talk about, you know, interviewing, and I know, like, you know, you recently spoke to Ryan and Odra, right? And they're doing with video interviewing and how do you capture analytics around that? They're doing some pretty cool things around that. But I agree, and we integrate with them. But what I agree is that, like, they have some stats, I think, that judges, you know, their conviction rates, I think, you know, after lunch or something like that, or the end of the day, or like, you know, two or three times higher than in the morning because they're just tired and cranky, and, you know, which is crazy because of the biases that creep into our judgment. So what can you do to be able to eliminate the biases and have more of an objective view of, like, you know, hey, you know, how you're assessing somebody, right? Because it will be different for me, like, you know, talking to someone, whether it's in the morning or if, like, you know, how my last meeting just went or what else is sort of hanging over my head. And so how can you use technology to do that? And then how do you actually also use your own tricks to do that? Like, you know, we do double interviews typically at Job Adder. So you have two people who are sort of like, you know, have different vantage points and you're not just, you know, siloing it.
Yeah. I mean, one of the best ways to do it is to get multiple people involved. And, and also on the analytics side, like if you know, for instance, that you get hangry, let's say, or, you know, then don't do interviews at the time when you're hungry. It's as basic as that. I remember sort of back in the day when I was recruiting for a business intelligence business, I was like an interim head of talent there. We were recruiting software people super hard then, as it is now, of course. And I managed to like hit a seam. So I ended up getting like some amazing candidates. And I was packing the CTO's schedule with all of these great candidates. And in the end, I noticed he started like cutting the interview short. And I was thinking, hey, man, what's going on? Are these guys no good? And he just said to me, listen, I have to be honest with you. I have this deadline in front of me that's crushing me. We have to get this feature out. And I'm cutting these interviews because I don't have the time. And then I realized, holy crap, I've totally failed to understand that his capacity is not fixed. It's going to fluctuate based on the business. My job was to better understand that and make sure I'm not doing things that add to his interview load. But I think, again, technology will help us do that because we'll be able to figure out, okay, what is the capacity of this person truly? Not self-reported stuff, because we all like to say, sure, we can do it. We can do this extra interview. But if he's like knocking people out because he's too busy to process it properly, it's a waste of everyone's time. We need to have more objective data on that.
Yeah, and I think that's what also makes this space so interesting to me. You know, because as you know, I'm not a recruiter by background. Nor have I done a lot of, you know, experience directly in recruitment. Although, you know, I've done some e-commerce or classifieds that have, you know, job categories and things like that. But that's what I find really fascinating, because, you know, we've got other technologies, right, that will help automate things that are more commoditized, like e-commerce, right? But humans can't really be commoditized. I mean, we try, right? We try to categorize, you know, functions and roles and skills and things like that, and categorize as much as we can. But humans are very complex and multi-layered and very dynamic. And it could depend on your birth order, like, you know, your culture, you know, your, you know, the food you ate that day. So you got that, which is one thing to be able to understand as a human being, but then magnify that, okay, well, all the other stakeholders in the recruitment process. right? So you've got the candidate and you've got the recruiter, or, you know, let's say internal TA. Sometimes you've got an external recruiter that they're, you're dealing with as well. And then you've got the hiring manager, sometimes at the very least. And so, and then, you know, that's what, one thing I've always found frustrating with, you know, hiring a lot of people in the past is, you know, a couple of things is, it's just getting on the same page. Like, you know, just how are we on the same page as, you know, not, I'm not talking just the external recruiter, like, you know, hey, make sure that we're thinking about the criteria, what's important from a job spec perspective, what's important in terms of those intangibles for the candidates. But I'm also even talking about the internal hire or the internal TA, be on the same page with him or her. And so you can imagine, just like Chinese whispers, like the inefficiencies that happen if you're not all in this, you know, singing from the same, you know, songbook, right? It's a, so how do we use technology to get, you know, more in that sort of like on the same page, you know, collaboratively sharing information across and being able to say, oh yeah, like now we're singing from the same, you know, song sheet.
Yeah, and you know what, I think that the kind of open source style of work, which is kind of bled very much into mainstream now, is going to really help with that. Because in you know, previous times, it was always one group of people coming up with some sort of information, documenting that, and then distributing that to another bunch of people. And there was an interpretive process there, because you just got this thing and you had to read it and try and figure out what that was, and you do something with that. And the more links in that chain, and before it hits the candidate, right, the more links in that chain, the more washed down it gets. And as you say, it's a Chinese whispers scenario. You have a different story from the origin to the end. And, you know, no surprise, the candidate ends up being disappointed, or, it's, you know, you get disappointed in a candidate and so on. But a more collaborative way of doing it, I think maybe the best way. Just as a thought experiment, probably most people would agree is good practice to, you know, jointly create the job description with the hiring manager, you know, in a collaborative document. You know, let's all put our stuff in together. That's a good idea. But how about we open it up to the candidate community? You know, how about we have a situation where you address the candidates saying, hey, we're building this head of go-to-market sort of job. We think we need this, this, and this. What do you think? And then have them contribute to it. You know, that might be a good way to start getting the what you want close to what the market thinks is available.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a twist I haven't heard yet. But that totally makes sense, right? Because I think we have often, as you know, whether it be recruiters or leaders or hiring managers, like, you know, it's we're time poor, and we're, you know, trying to control things, right? But then typically, you know, we know we don't have all the answers. So how can we actually crowdsource that? How can we open source that? And I love, like, the fact that you use that Google Docs, you know, metaphor analogy, right? So how do you Google Docify the recruitment process, or Sockify the recruitment process in a way where you're open, and so you can edit things real time, et cetera, and to be able to get on the same page. Because I think what we at JobAdder, I think, have done pretty well is that we've automated certain processes from the very beginning, of course, starting with job posting to multiple job boards. But then how do we actually continue that within for the recruiter? But then there's all these sort of connection points and automation points, you know, with all of the other stakeholders. So, you know, as we go more on for the hiring managers and getting them on the same page with the internal recruiters, and then, you know, with the external agencies as well. And then, yes, with the candidates, right? Because going back to your first example, right, when you hit that seam, that was a good way of saying it. Like, you know, you just all these great candidates. And then, you know, the CTO, was it, you know, was just, you know, cutting them short because he had a deadline. Like, how bad, like, was it for those candidates, right? Like, you know, when they're all stoked about the potential job and getting cut short because it's something that could have been totally, you know, handled in a better way.
Yeah, there's so many better ways we can do it. And as you say, Martin, I love the fact that you're kind of leaning into the idea that there's a lot of human sort of the human factors are still prominent. I mean, technology needs to be very aligned with how humans behave, because fundamentally, these are human process problem issues more than anything else. Martin, let's rewind back the clock. When you started your career, was business leadership sort of very clear in your mind when you were young and coming into the world of work, or, you know, did you have a different vision, or was it always going to be this way as you were going forward?
Yeah, I'm just laughing because, like, you know, I think maybe, you know, we all do that. We look back and, like, you know, maybe a year ago, maybe 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And we said, wow, how naive was I? I think trying to come up with a more abridged version of this, right? Because we could be here for a long time and let's just start keep pontificating. But so when I didn't really know exactly what I wanted to do, when I was, went to university, I had good role models, right? I had my dad who was, he worked on Wall Street at one point, and then he went to work with a friend to run a business, actually manufacturing. And then I had an older sister who also went into Wall Street after doing economics at an Ivy League school. So I had to, these are my role models. These are people I'm going to go after. That seems like right. And like, I grew up in New England, in the States. And it's just, this is in the 80s, right? And then going to the 90s when I graduated high school, early 90s. And I just kind of followed the herd, right? Like, if you wanted to if you essentially do what more successful people were doing, you studied economics or finance in university and then you went into banking. That's what I did. And then I just didn't learn what I wanted to be more until, I had ideas, I had benchmarks, but it was just about going through it, actually experiencing work itself to then start to realize, oh wait, I don't really like this. What about that? So I went into banking, Wall Street, I was like, I don't know. I couldn't put my finger on, but I was like, this is not for me. And now I tell you exactly why, but at the point I didn't really know. And so then I said, well, I want to do something that if I'm going to be working this hard, I'm going to be spending 70, 80% of my waking hours working, then I better really believe in whatever we're producing, whatever product is, whatever service is, and really love the people I'm working with. And so I didn't know much at that point other than, hey, I love movies and I love entertainment. I want to get into, the business of entertainment. And that led to digital media because that was a dot-com boom. And that ultimately led to e-commerce. And so so that was sort of like more the industry passion. But then I did have a sense that I did have a role model with my dad in terms of running his business. And I felt like that there are moments where, okay, I'm going to follow this path where I want to be closer to decision-making as in informing the higher level decisions. That's why I got into strategy. But this is a nice bridge for me to train up on how to actually take control, take ownership of a business at some point. So it was sort of just a few different bridges along the way that sort of got me to being a GM or being a CEO. It didn't have it wasn't something I had concocted, way back when.
It's fascinating, Martin. I totally resonate with your early journey. My journey also, you were kind of all in a, as you say, herd follower. I was in the herd, go to university. That was obvious. I was going to do that. Get a white collar job. It was kind of obvious. I was going to do that. Whatever it was, it didn't really matter. You're on that middle class track or whatnot, work hard 20 years, whatever, hit a partnership or whatnot. And that's you. I'm very pleased it didn't go out like that, but I just wonder how many people do end up doing it, and because they're smart and diligent and what have you, and they actually are successful, but it may not necessarily be the optimal thing that they're there for. And I do know a lot of people that are in this. They've been a lawyer for 20 years, or they've been an accountant for 20 years and so on. They hate their jobs, and it's like, oh, I get it, and they're just like counting the hours down, the years down before they hit this thing, and then they're out, and you think, oh goodness me, that's like, I wouldn't want to be on that track where you despise what you do, that's tough.
There's probably three categories, right? Because you imagine there are people, right, who don't follow the herds, right? There are people who, from day one, they're different, they do something different. But the majority of people, right, we're social animals, right? There's a herd mentality. So, but there's probably three categories, right, of those people. One is the people that follow the herd, and then they excel, right? They excel in actually running that rat race, and they like that, right? Like, that's where they get the value because they are, in the front, right? It's not necessarily the profession itself. They may not love the actual ins and outs of accounting or corporate law, but they love being in the front of it and, being in front of that. Maybe they love that, the parts of it as well. And if they're really good, of course, you're going to. You got the second category who also excel, you know, well, probably first category is they love it and they excel. Second category is they don't love it, but they still excel and it pays their wages.
Yep.
And then you got the third category, which is where I start off in finance, where it's like, I'm not good at it. I got to, or don't like it. I got to do something else.
You were lucky, Martin, because you might have been second category, right? You might have been slightly better at what you were doing. That, and that might encourage you to have persisted, and you might have just ended up being like a mediocre banker, let's say, and then, you know, grinding away in that huge middle gap of people and, you know, and doing okay, but not really thriving. And you just wonder how many people might actually be in that boat. I thank God that I failed those entry assessments when I was going in, and I failed the investment banking stuff. Thank the Lord, you know. I was outraged at the time. I thought, you know, how could I fail this? Now I look back at it and I think, you know what? God dealt me a good hand there, because I was not suited for that environment. That was very clear. It's clear to me now. But I'm also one of these that is prepared to grind also. So I know that had I got in, I'd work hard and I wouldn't fail because of lack of hard work, but I might have ended up being, you know, not too happy or pleased with myself going into that type of world. It's interesting that you understood that strategy was a pathway, though. So once you got into the world of work and understood how things were happening, why did you? It seemed that then that's when you started to, if you like, design the career path a little bit more. Yeah. What sort of things that did you understand you lacked? That you wanted to fill in order to move forward that way. I wonder whether that might be interesting to explore a little bit in case we have any kind of young business people or young entrepreneurial types just listening into this.
Yeah. Well, if I go back to that period of time when I decided, like, you know, I followed the herd into finance, and then ironically, and I'll tell you why it's ironic, I sort of, you know, didn't follow the herd into business school. The reason why I say didn't follow the herd into business school, as in, yes, going into business school or graduate school is sometimes a hurting kind of stage. But typically when you go to business school, you're going into a profession like finance, or you're going to, you know, the banking or consulting, at least, you know, in the States and in New York where I was. And I went to actually get out of finance. I went to get, you know, into essentially media entertainment, which I was quite interested in, and technology as well, kind of came in, you know, just sort of by virtue of being interested in media tech, particularly media entertainment at that time. And I realized, well, then I started to think, well, the best way for me to enter into this industry, right, is to use my skill sets. What can I bring, right? I'm not a creator, right? I'm not a content creator. I'm not, like, you know, someone who's in the business or has relationships, but I can think maybe it's about applying sort of business strategy to help a company think through things. So I did consider going to consulting. Actually, at the time, I had a consulting offer that wasn't pulled away because the 2001 sort of bust. And then I was able to land a job into internal strategy team, actually at LexisNexis at the time, and that lasted for a year. And there was a reorg, and then I ended up at Dow Jones on the electronic, the Wall Street Journal Online. Basically, I was doing strategy for Wall Street Journal Online. And the reason why I just went for it is because, well, hey, how do I get in? How do I get into the industry? And then also, it's just also, I love thinking that way. I love thinking about big problems and how to break those down and how to communicate that and get people to organize against those problems. Like that, I love doing that. We had a call earlier this morning. We were getting a bunch of leaders across JobAdder with one of the problems that we're dealing right now. And I just love laying that out and saying, here's what it is. Here's like the framework, guys, and I'll give you ownership because we're all in this together. So that to me just felt like a natural way to sort of get into, if I can figure out the strategy bit, then get closer to how decisions are made. And then maybe I can get into a role where actually I can make those decisions. And honestly, like, you know, you read all these books, whether it be Malcolm Gladwell, like, you know, Outliers, right? You realize, you know, success is, yeah, it's grit, it's talent. A lot of it's circumstance, right? It's being the right place at the right time. And when I went to eBay for a strategy role, I had the opportunity to step into a general manager role for a startup business to run, you know, the classifieds business in the US. And so, yeah, I lucked out to be able to, you know, walk through that door after I was doing strategy.
You know what? It's really interesting you say, and yeah, I think I'm totally with Gladwell that we have to accept that the distribution of opportunities is often random. But at the same time, it seems to me that your strategic thinking helped you increase the chances of those random hits. And I wonder whether, and there's been some evidence about sort of people like researching, like how do you get lucky? Because it seems to be certain people are fortuitous. And you know, why is that? And it turns out that they're just more sensitive to opportunities. And they create circumstances of that are non-designed, but they put themselves into circumstances where those opportunities are more likely to happen. And I think your reading of, you know, the dot-com boom and the beginnings of this emergent sort of future, and again, the thinking of like getting into that, like just land there into this big boat, into this big new industry, good things are going to happen if you're in that space. That in itself is good strategic thinking. And in fact, again, it resonates a lot with me, Martin, because it's basically the only strategy I do is that. I mean, I kind of accept my competence level is like, I wouldn't say mediocre, that's false modesty, but I'm certainly not great at many things, right? So I think I'm pretty good at most things, but not great at, you know, exceptional stuff. But what I think I am pretty good at is looking at where the big movements are and just making sure I'm sort of positioned a little bit ahead of the wave, so the wave's going to carry me there. So I kind of visualize myself as a poor swimmer, but I know where the tide is. You know, it's like just go. The tide's going to carry you to shore, man. You know, that's the way it goes.
Yeah, let me jump in on that because I'm so glad that you used the word wave and waves, and I'm going to take that. I'm going to take it very literally, because there's two elements that I wanted to pick up on there. There's the one is what you said in terms of, you know, applying strategy to be able to sort of get into, you know, the direction you want to go to. And the other is more of an attitude, which is around, like we say, presenting yourself to opportunities or finding opportunities, right? And if I look back at, like, you know, how I'm wired a bit, maybe I built this over time, is that I just love challenges, right? So I love to be able to go up against something, get knocked down and try again. And so, you know, being in Australia, of course, from the States, you know, my wife and I and the family, if we've taken up surfing, it's like, you know, you're going to be in Sydney. Like, why would you not surf? It's kind of like my mentality. It's like living in Switzerland and not going skiing. So we took that up 4 or 5 years ago, and I love it. I'm absolutely hooked, And I'm not that good, but I love going out there. And like, I realized, like, you know, we had this massive swell that was coming through last weekend, and huge, like just massive, like 10, 15 foot waves. And my wife's like, do not go out there. And I'm like, well, I'll just, you know, that's, I'll be safe. But I couldn't, like, you know, if whether, you know, I just can't help it, right? I have to, if there's something there, I just love to be able to just throw me in there, right? I just want to throw myself in there and see what happens. And I'm not crazy, but I just, you know, it's maybe the adrenaline or whatever it may be. It's like, I'd like to be able to try something and then, you know, I don't like to get knocked down, but I like to be able to get back up and then try it again and sort of figure it out that way. So maybe in some cases I've done that, you know, with too much blunt force, where, you know, I'm not thinking through things, you know, ahead of time. But if you do combine both, where you see the trends are going, and to find what's going to be successful, and you just give it everything, that's a good combination.
Maybe that type of experimental attitude is also a key component of being a successful business leader, you know, where you're prepared to get close to the edges of comfort zone, right? You need to push against that edge and expose yourself to vulnerability, getting knocked down, for instance, but then have the confidence that getting up is something you're going to do. And I think where people don't sort of experiment is where they fear not being able to get back up again, and they doubt their own resilience. But the truth of the matter is, most people do get up. Most people can get up, and that needs to be a lot, like, you need to test that so that you kind of build the confidence that you can do this. Is the thing that makes you do it, and it's one of those, you know, it's another perspective of where, you know, failure is the key ingredients to future success. And it's to understand that actually you need to just lower the anxiety level of failure. So in other words, it's just another opportunity to figure out the problem. And you figured out that's not the way to go. Can you even repeat the failure? Sometimes it's useful to say, is my analysis of the reason why I failed correct? Let's test it again. I'm going to do these things, monitor it. Does this guarantee failure? If it does, great, tick a box, because you know that's definitely something you shouldn't want to do, and try something else.
Yeah, I think you know, saying celebrate failure and actually being able to do that is very different. Like, you know, and so how do you do that? Because the idea of being celebrating failure, I mean, it means that you're trying something, and that, you know, with that failure comes, you know, some kind of learning. And so at my old company, what we do is every Friday we would have some kind of showcase. You know, it was a great way to end the week, right? Like, you know, we'd have 3 p.m., beer o'clock Friday, you know, beers come out, everyone gets together. We show essentially what the, you know, the engineers or product managers had, you know, are either working on or just released, right? Which is also one of the reasons I love to do what I'm doing, is actually build stuff and then be able to release it and get feedback and see how it goes. And then we realized that we started to get into a pattern of, you know, only celebrating the stuff that was successful, right? Just like, hey, like, you know, yeah, we shipped this and it did that. And then the customer said this, versus, you know, we realized, well, hey, what about actually celebrating some of the failures that we did, or things that we tried, but not the failures themselves, like, yay, like it didn't work, but actually the learnings that we got from it, right? And so, and just be able to walk through that process. Remember the first time we did this, it was hard. Like, it was like this weird, awkward moment, right? Where I remember the product manager at the time, Mike, he was talking through it, and, like, you know, just, he didn't have the energy for it, right? He, you know, it's a different energy. And you're sort of forcing it a bit, but it sort of was a bit of a breakthrough where you just say, hey, you're celebrating the fact that you tried and learned something. And I think that if you do more of that, then it sort of starts to create that culture of, like, you know, experimentation.
Yeah, and oftentimes it's about having fun with it. Like, you not that these things are jokes, because they're obviously serious work, but you have to have a sense of humor about something that you didn't pull off in the way that you wanted to have happen. You say, hey, look, this is not, yeah, do it with a smile. And that helps you change the perspective on it. And you're not like catastrophizing over something that didn't work out, but you're trying to figure, okay, we've learned these things as a result of this. And as you say, it's not about celebrating failure per se, because that can obviously, you know, we don't rejoice in the fact that it didn't work, but we should rejoice in the fact of the courage to do experimentation, and that you're still standing, you're still repeating and keeping going. Very, very interesting. Okay, let's move on to talking about running this ship currently, Martin. How is recruiting technology business different from e-commerce and media? I mean, are there any like key differences from the CEO's job from running a different type of business?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of differences, but there are also lots of similarities. I mean, you know, it would be weird if I set up here and said, yeah, recruitment is exactly like e-commerce. But like, you know, let's actually start with the similarities, right? Like, you know, in terms of, you know, and then we can flip it, because the differences are more obvious. And there's probably two aspects, right? One is actually, so what I'm doing, you know, with JobAdder is very similar to what I've done before, which is building a technology or a product for end users and trying to make that amazing and provide an amazing level of customer support. Like, those are fundamentals. And then, you know, the similarity is like, is the attention to user experience, right? I think, and that's probably one of the assets I can bring coming outside of recruitment, is that although I don't have experience as a recruiter or lots of experience doing recruitment specific technology, I have a lot of consumer facing technology experience. And with consumer-facing technology experience, there's a lot of discipline around the user interface, around the user interaction, like how you're reducing friction and simplifying things as much as possible. And I think that level of discipline sometimes can be, you know, less common in B2B and traditionally more IT kind of applications. One, because you just don't have that level of, judgment and, you know, adoption you know, because when you build a website, a consumer-facing website, it's a free classified site, for example, you either know right away if people are using it or not, right? The success or failure is immediate. When you're doing B2B and SaaS, you can hide things with a demo, right? And you can, you know, you can get that, you know, that product in, and then, like, you know, then you've got a user. But so that discipline of actually making the experience really, really seamless and smooth, et cetera, I think that's where the, you know, the similarities can be, you know, closer together. Like, hey, we should provide an experience for recruiters that is amazing, as simple, as intuitive. It just, we're one step ahead, right? We can know the next thing that you need to do and to be able to get you through there. So I think that's sort of, you know, one overall sort of, you know, overlap that is there. The other thing I was thinking about this too, differences between e-commerce and recruitment, I kind of touched on it before, is that e-commerce is kind of commoditized in a way, because you can categorize and you can automate certain things around things, right? It's a marketplace. You've got buyers and sellers on one side, and you've got things that are exchanged, and that those things could be it could be books, it could be shoes, it could be TVs, it could be houses. Humans are much more complex, right? And that's where, you know, the differences lie in, is that, and that's where I think you have lots of fears of disintermediation in the industry, right? Lots of fears that, like, you know, hey, technology is going to disintermediate you. Recruiters will never be disintermediated, because it's a human to human, you know, interaction that's so important. Technology will only sort of improve that interaction. So I think, like, you know, you think about, like, you know, why Amazon first got into, you know, the first category it got into was books, right? Because it could be easily categorized. And all that had, like, you know, essentially the right kind of, can't remember what this is called, the ISTN or the barcodes to be able to be scanned. And then it sort of worked its way from out there. Recruitment, I think, is really, you know, different in that it's about actually assisting a very human relationships and sort of the transactions around those relationships. Last probably thought on this, because I can go many different directions, is that one of the other similarities I see, because I have a marketplace kind of mentality, is that I often think about, you know, recruitment is about matching, right? So at the end of the day, you're matching companies with candidates and candidates with jobs and companies. And so there are inherent marketplaces, you know, throughout the whole process. There's the actual, you know, demand for the job and supply of talent, but there's also other marketplaces or matching areas that, you know, we can actually, you know, take advantage of. And we just talked about some of them in terms of how we collaborate. But what about agencies working with other agencies and sharing candidates and sharing jobs to be able to fill those roles? What about, you know, companies trying to go out there, and if they're looking for potentially their next recruitment partner to out there, how matching with that recruitment partner that's going to best fit for them? So there's a lot of sort of overlaps and similarities in that way too.
Oh yeah, I mean the last point I think is super interesting, because supply selection how do you know? I mean, I get this asked all the time on a daily basis. People ask me, hey, I'm recruiting in this country, no idea what to do about it. Can you recommend a supply home? You know, everybody. I can't help. I don't know. But some sort of way to sort that out and be able to say, you know what, this company seems to be the one that is suitable for your needs right now. That could be, that's a whole new product set. That it's a whole new product, marketplace product that could be very useful to deal with. In fact, actually, Jonathan Romley came on to Founders Focus a couple of episodes previous. He's building something along those lines. So yeah, there's all kinds of, as you say, marketplace issues going on. Really fascinated to hear about your consumer sort of experience as well, Martin, because it is true to say we are all consumers, and we've all been trained at a certain level of expectation of our online experiences. And I know a great deal of the frustrations that people have in recruitment, as either candidates or recruiters as users of recruiting software, is that they're bringing their consumer level expectations to sometimes old products and legacy products that really didn't even think about UX or UI, or certainly not user experience, when they were building this stuff. And you'd be amazed that some of this old technology is still getting implemented today. I went to an event yesterday, Talent Palooza, brilliant event. And I was speaking to some folks who were working in education, I think, over in Melbourne. And they were saying, we just completed our installation of Taleo. And I was like, no disrespect to Taleo, right? But it was like, what? Like, this is the new implementation of, I don't know what you're replacing, right? So they must have spent whatever it is to get rid of what the previous was. And they said, look, the procurement life cycle of this was literally decades out. So by the time they actually make an innovative decision to the point where it's implemented, it's already probably obsolete. So it's crazy that there's this time lag in different sort of industry sectors and what have you. And like I say, big opportunity for companies that are able to prioritize their the usability of their software.
Yeah, and I think that kind of blows my mind in a couple of different ways. It's either, and I think that's, and you would know this very well, how, you know, if I'm making a choice for a new technology, a new ATS, new CRM, where do I go? And what do I trust? Because you can go to some of the aggregator sites, like, you know, Software Advice or what have you, all the ratings are very, very similar, right? Like, you know, that, and there's so much choice if you're actually even taking those steps. And a lot of people don't even take those steps. They're probably just, hey, you know, such and such use this product, so I'm going to use this product as well. So there's either, like, you know, the actually how the making the choice, and then, but, you know, that's sort of one sort of, you know, thing that sort of just blows my mind in terms of the lack of, you know, clarity in terms of, okay, what's out there, what actually, you know, is the best fit for you. And the other is actually the fact that, like, many people don't even invest in it, right? Like, you know, and like don't even have, they're hiring dozens and dozens of people, and they're using spreadsheets, or they're using, you know, a really subpar recruitment module, you know, success factors or whatever it may be, that doesn't even do recruitment. And, like, when recruiting talent right now is, like, the number one priority for, you know, all CEOs and leaders, you know, across the business, is, like, the fact that you don't have something that's dedicated to that, or using spreadsheets, or using a premise-based solution that's, you know, decades old. That's just, it blows my mind.
Yeah, it's incredible. But again, it just shows that certain companies have been able to persist, and certain organizations, institutions, they're not necessarily exposed to the, if you like, the sharp edge of a hostile market, let's say, and they're able to just continue with really old processes. It reminds me of evolution in many cases. Like, we're in Australia, for instance, and, you know, the isolation of Australia obviously enabled a very unique ecosystem to evolve here, which needs to be protected and preserved, because there's other species that are evolved in different places that actually would be hugely damaging to this ecosystem, because they would be able to outcompete. And I would imagine there's certain segments of industry in certain regions, let's say, or certain pockets that are kind of like isolated. And they've been able to exist in a sort of an isolated format. And as they get integrated, or as they come into contact with, you know, other people, systems, processes, candidates, suddenly those old things that used to work or used to be okay turn into debilitating handicaps. It's fascinating. Martin, let's talk about the roadmap. Like, one of the things, so it's interesting, you kind of came into the job from outside of the business. How much sort of influence, or how much did you put it upon yourself to influence product direction? Or did you, like, I was just wondering, you know, you came in from outside of the industry, you're CEO of the business. CEO often is the person that does have product direction and say, we're going to do this. How have you sort of dealt with, if you like, the domain sort of gap from coming in, and the potential responsibility you have for setting the direction of where you want Job Addr to build?
Yeah, I mean, if I came in and, you know, right from the start, and then started telling, you know, what we should be doing on the product side, then that would be a massive mistake. One, because that's really not the role I should be playing, and two, is be doing a disservice to our customers. So I think you know, when you are a startup founder, you know, that's typically where you start. You're hands-on with the product, right? And you're the customer, you're building it, you're hearing from the customers, and it's a very hands-on thing. And sometimes when you scale up, it is hard to let that go, but you know, and that doesn't mean you have to let go completely, but it does mean you have to give room for people to, you know, run that and own those decisions. And then your remit becomes a bit different. It becomes, okay, well, how am I actually, you know, thinking about culture of the organization? How am I thinking about, you know, making sure we've got the right funding for the organization? Do we've got the right team? We've got the right org design, and we're set up the right kind of like, you know, set up as a team to make sure that we're making the right product decisions. So for me, the first thing was like, well, I was quite fortunate where I was brought in, and Brett, you know, the founder who was doing a lot of the product in the past, we had a nice overlap and handover. He also brought in, right before I arrived, Owen Senior, who's our CPTO, both in charge of product and technology, who's also really, really good about building great product technology teams. He doesn't have recruitment experience, but he's really good about building up product and technology teams and the disciplines around that. So my first question, I remember having this meeting with Owen when I first arrived. First off, I was like, oh man, this is gonna be great. I love this guy. Like, you know, I love how he thinks. He's, you know, super smart, it's funny as hell. You know, one of the first things we talked about in that meeting was, okay, well, what's our NPS? You know, what's our voice of our customer? What are they saying? And we had elements of that at JobAdder, but it hadn't really been, you know, came through because I remember, you know, at the time I was being recruited for another role too. Actually, it was a CEO of an e-commerce company. And the reason why they're recruiting me is because they wanted me to come in because I knew a lot about e-commerce, and they wanted me to actually solve specifically user experience or product issues. It's like, I don't want to be your CEO if that's what you want me for. And I don't want to hear you as a board member telling me what we should be fixing in the product. That's not like, you know, what my role is. I mean, yes, I want to have influence over that. And I want to, so it's really about the disciplines to make sure, hey, how is our teams tied into what the customers are saying and where the trends are going and you'll see around the corner, so then we can make sure we're steering properly.
Yeah, and maybe that's actually the advantage of kind of an industry agnostic CEO, let's say, or someone who's got some distance to the product. Because you know, you're not sort of head in the weeds kind of thing. You're basically always operating at the upper level of it, and you can see sort of you can pilot the direction in a different way through influencing and leaning on, should I say, you know, key leaders that are already in place. 2022, what exciting things are in the product roadmap for current and future customers of JobAdder, Martin? Can you give us a few like teasers that, you know, stuff that you've got in the pipe?
Yeah, I mean, when we think about the product, we think about JobAdder. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and spew off a big long feature list because that's one of the things that we like to do is just make sure what we're actually building, what's, you know, actually everything that's there. Works really, really well. So again, there's always room for improvement there. So one of the things we'll be looking at is actually how do we get more consistent design and usability across all the different modules and workflows. And it's constantly pushing on that, right? If we're not pushing that, someone's going to come up with a better mousetrap. So that's a lot for the design improvements that we'll be doing. I mean, retain search continues to be more important for agencies. It needs to go in that way, more of a partnership. So how we're actually building that out so it's, you know, unbundled recruitment basically, and how we can actually, you know, support that in terms of that business model. So we think about our core product and what we do there. So those are a couple of big ones. And then we also think about, okay, well, we're part of an ecosystem. We have an ecosystem around us. So we're doing tons of stuff when it comes to integrations, right? Because, you know, if you're, you know, within a company and recruiting, how you're integrating with all the other systems needs to be work really well. So we'll do integrations with Bamboo HR. We got integrations with QuickBooks. And then also we have integrations, you know, we've done quite a bunch with LinkedIn, and we're going to continue that in terms of how we integrate with LinkedIn. So ultimately, you know, at the end of the day, we want you to be really successful as a recruiter using JobAdder and leveraging your database. And making sure that you're surfacing the candidates that you want, that you need to, and that you're not going externally and paying externally, But where you can actually have those integrations, whether it be LinkedIn Recruiter or here in Australia with Seek Talent Search Connect, we want to make that super easy so you can, you know, be more and more efficient. So those are a few of the things.
Very interesting. Another question, not related to the product, but more to kind of market strategy. A job adder, reputed, obviously very strong in APAC and Asia in particular. The need is obviously to break out of that and make sure, you know, dominant positions in other parts of the world. What's the go-to strategy there? What can we expect to see from job adder from, a noise-making perspective in next year?
Yeah, our core is and always will be, you know, the smaller agencies based here in Australia and New Zealand. However, when I came into the business, it was pretty cool to see that we started to get like this traction in other areas, not because we said, hey, we're going to go there specifically and start to do this, but we actually had recruiters just bring job adder with them. So we had a lot of, you know, British recruiters come to Australia, right, on expats, you go to an agency, use job adder, they brought it back with them, right? So we've seen a lot of that. And so we've actually built up quite a bit of traction momentum, as you would know, in the UK. We've seen a little bit of pockets of that in North America as well, particularly in Canada and across the states a bit here and there. So we're just amplifying that overseas reach, particularly in the, you know, the agency side, a little bit on the in-house side. We've also had lots of success, again, with recruiters going from the agency side. They love it, and they brought it in-house. Like, you know, we haven't actually said, hey, you know, corporates, companies, in-house recruiters, here's job adder. They brought it inside with them. And now we're following them, right? So, okay, hey, how do we improve that? How do we get more of the hiring manager functionality to be even better? Like, you know, that whole sort of those flows across those stakeholders that I mentioned. So that's the second big area. And then, like, you know, just as we sort of work up that food chain with the smaller agencies to the bigger agencies. So it's like we're going essentially down paths that our customers are kind of leading the charge from. And I think that's a really successful strategy. If the customers are want us, then we try and follow that and back it up.
Yeah, I can totally see it's like an organic way of spreading rather than trying like brute force, which obviously requires ridiculous amount of marketing effort. And oftentimes it doesn't stick because the inherent interest in the users is not there for whatever reason it might be. Okay, Martin, we're coming to the very end of the show. So I wanted to just ask you a final question before we let you go on with your busy CEOing day. Advice that you'd give to a budding business leader that's coming up, what's the one thing that you could say that, you know what, this is a really quite important lesson for you to learn it now, otherwise, you know, it'll save you time basically if you paid attention to this one thing on your entrepreneurial career?
It's coincidental or not so coincidental. That's really about surrounding yourself with the best people. So if you are a budding entrepreneur or you are stepping into a leadership role, or, you know, you're going to need people to help out and to go on that journey with you. Just like in recruitment, you shouldn't settle you need to find somebody who's amazing. And then maybe that person is amazing. They thought it was amazing. It comes in and it didn't work out. You do your best to be able to coach that person or that team, but then you can't settle for that either, right? So where I've made, I think, and this is often I trade notes with other, you know, leaders or CEOs, like it's always the number one thing. It's like not letting go or moving on from people on your team soon enough so you can sort of build the right team.
Yep.
And if you've got the right people and you've got, you know, the vision and everything else follows, right? So I think that's really number one.
Yeah, so that's it. It's a people business. Every business is a people business, and you've just got to be able to select the right folks to go on that journey with you. Fantastic stuff. Martin, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. I think we could obviously talk for longer, but I don't want to take any more of your time, seeing as you are busy and also ill. So I want to wish you a full and rapid recovery, you and your family. You know, obviously, I'm coming into the job ad office next week. I'm not sure whether you're going to be fit enough to be in there. So it'd be a shame if you won't be able to catch up. But if somehow you do make it in some way, it'd be great to see you. But it's been a pleasure having you on Founders Focus. Great to chat with you and learn from your lessons in leadership, man.
Thank you for having me. It's been awesome. And hopefully I see you soon.
Take care, Martin.
Okay, bye.
What a cool dude. I really enjoy speaking with Martin Herbst, CEO of JobAdda. And it's a really impressive product, by the way. You should certainly check it out if you are a recruitment agency, whether you're an APAC or not. Okay, that's about it for me. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back. I think next week we're going to be still doing Breakthrough Live. I'll still be in Australia. And I believe I will be speaking to Dr. Richard Clayden. He is I think one of the most innovative writers and thinkers on organizational culture and organizational design. We're going to be talking about leadership fit for a remote first world. It's going to be a one-to-one conversation. I promise you it will be worth your time. Make sure you follow the channel. We'll give you an update from there. When we go live, you'll be notified on email and also push notification. Okay, that's about it. Thanks for watching, everyone.